For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone.
But we can't ignore the math, okay? We can't ignore the data.
Go on Google Trends, type in your name, then type in mine. You're a straight line. I'm a pyramid.
I like the very direct question on that.
Television ratings, downward spiral. Buy rates, plummeting.
The time is now to turn the math around.
And we are back. It is John Pollock and Brandon Thurston. After 1 week off, we are recharged, reset, and ready to go as we enter the TKO boxing era that we will be discussing in depth on today's show, along with many other topics. Brandon, how are you?
I'm good. I heard you were on vacation. I listened to talk this morning on the drive-in, and I'm never going on a vacation now, ever.
Did I scare
after
you?
After hearing what you went through.
Well, the immigration process to get into Mexico through the airport that I went was quite the hassle. It was quite the battle with my sanity, but we came out of it the other way, and here I am, still alive and well, and back in Canada.
I don't go on vacations. I don't know when the last time. I don't know if I've ever been on a vacation in my adult life.
Yeah,
and I have no interest.
This is my first vacation in over a decade. That was non-work related.
Why would you want to leave work and not work?
Yeah, I mean, you could, you could just have your laptop and phone glued to your sides and appendages, and just navigate life that way. But you will be getting on a plane in not too many weeks. Is this correct? You are still on for Las Vegas next month.
Yes, I'm going to Las Vegas. That's the plan. I could always cancel those plans at any moment, I think, without much of a fee. I'm planning on going to Las Vegas for WrestleMania weekend. Yeah.
Yeah. But Brandon was sitting on the fence, but then when he heard the rumor about the natural disasters going into the Hall of Fame, that solidified Brandon's travel plans.
John Tenta, come on.
Of course, another great Canadian, and Uncle Fred Ottman, also yes. Members of the Natural Disasters going into the Hall of Fame.
How many Shockmaster references will there be in that Hall of Fame ceremony for them?
Whatever the number is, it'll be followed by a painful amount. That will likely be, I imagine, like that's going to be how he enters on the stage.
Yeah.
It should be really funny for a joke.
There's going to be a Stormtrooper helmet that's going to go falling and rolling at some point.
It certainly would be within line. I mean, after they got out all of their fun with Medusa coming back, with the belt being retrieved from the garbage after all those years, they really do love their sight gags at the Hall of Fame. So you will be going to both nights of WrestleMania, I presume. Is that mainly the
show? Who knows?
Oh,
who knows? I don't know. I would have to be credentialed by WWE, so we'll see if that happens.
Sometimes that is a – I do recall last year's WrestleMania. It was touch and go if you were actually going to be going with us to WrestleMania or not.
Well, there's a process that I've learned. I've learned how to go about that process since then.
Okay. Well, that's great news. I will be spending WrestleMania weekend in this chair, and Brandon. I'll be doing about 5,000 shows. You're welcome to join me on any one of those 5,000 if you so choose. Just chances are if you just log in,
Drop into the StreamYard room and just
odds are announce. You don't even need a time. You log in, I'll be here probably talking, and you have an open door policy. Okay, you have the keys to the post wrestling world at all times when you're down in Las Vegas. But we will be talking about that more in the weeks to come. Today, we are going to be joined by reporter John Nash from Hey Not The Face, a guy that has been doing excellent reporting on the MMA industry at large, and somebody that also covers boxing pretty thoroughly, which we will be discussing more with him. The advent of TKO officially putting its name into the boxing mix last week with Turki Alashik, Saudi Arabia, and Dana White alongside Nick Khan. What a group to have together to take on the boxing industry.
Well, Mark Shapiro says that Dana and Nick are experts in boxing. Nick has some history. You have to remind me who he represented a boxing manager after there was a dispute at a FedEx store.
It was Freddie Roach. He also had involvement with Manny Pacquiao early in his career. Like Nick Khan is pretty, like his early roots in representation is very much tied to boxing. Coming up in Las Vegas, I mean, that is kind of a natural segue for him in the sports world. So, I mean, Nick Khan is somebody that does have a boxing history, as does Dana White that preceded mixed martial arts.
Right.
So we will be covering boxing on a week-to-week basis. Moving forward, a whole new industry to tackle. But we will talk about that a little later on. Since we were last here, we had a TKO earnings call. Mark Shapiro took in another edition of Raw this past Monday, getting front row seats at Madison Square Garden.
Nice.
Yeah, so a great, always great to see Mark Shapiro. And coming out of the TKO earnings, for people that wanted to figure out how much money is TKO making and where is it all coming from? The always color coordinated Brandon Thurston putting together this wonderful, what style of chart is this identified as?
This is called a Sankey diagram. I've learned.
I love it.
It and I put some things in here that are estimates and media reports that go beyond just what they reported in their nice table that they publish every quarter. But I mean, it gives you a visual representation of how much revenue is coming in. And in the case of this calendar year, they had some what they would probably call one-time expenses. In the case of the antitrust lawsuit, that's accounting for $375 million of what would have been contributed to profit if not for that. And they have, I think it's a good representation here of just how much the debt servicing, that is probably the interest that they're paying on their debt, is affecting their profitability too. But they had some profitability of $6.4 million. That is net income. It was a great year for UFC and WWE financially, certainly.
Yeah, when you can stomach a $375 million settlement with fighters for one of two antitrust suits and still come out the other end profitability-wise, it's a very strong year for the entire TKO empire. And you still do have another looming antitrust suit that could have a settlement attached to it this year or next.
Are they not counting both antitrust lawsuits in that $375?
No,
Rick, that's just the one.
That's just the UFC one. And then there's the added $20 million that was on top of
MLW.
The legal expenses, yes, in the WWE. Yes. And then Vince McMahon legal expenses thrown in there. So it was a nice 400 plus year when it came to legal expenses, the price of doing business.
Yeah, some litigation that they're going through.
So any takeaways from the earnings report and the call with analysts afterward? I mean, a lot of the focus, again, this was almost 2 weeks ago, was on the boxing front. This preceded the official announcement last week. But Mark Shapiro, as he stated, was willing to give some more color and pretty much laid out the game plan of what's going to be happening with this boxing league, confirming that they would be not putting in any of its own capital. This would all be funded by the Saudis, and that they would be taking a $10 million license essentially to promote, to serve as the promoter and producer of these events, and then over a 5-year period, if they reach these markers, there would be equity for TKO to achieve and have in this boxing promotion,
right? Which is I think important for investors to hear, so that they don't worry that TKO is making this big investment, and there are concerns here about you know, the interest expense that they're paying and all that. They want to make sure that investors understand this is only going to be contributed to their profitability.
Value accretive.
Brandon. Yes. Yes. The industrial logic is really helping them out. It sounds like there's going to be two events this year that will not actually be a part of whatever this TKO branded boxing league is. That's coming, according to the Associated Press, that's coming in 2026, but they're going to have these, what Mark Shapiro called these sort of one-off events, two of them, I think, in 2025. And I think
one of them set for Times Square in May, which I understand goes for they're going to block off a portion of Times Square, which is super cheap. It's a pretty empty part of the country that you can just block off at a fraction of a cost to run a boxing event.
Is that real? Is that true? They're going to go do a fight in Times Square.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Turkey is initiating this along with a proposed event on Alcatraz Island as well. You ever been to Alcatraz for boxing?
No, I have not. Speaking of Saudi Arabia, there's not just going to be two Saudi Arabia events for WWE next year with Royal Rumble. Royal Rumble is just an additional event. There will be three Saudi Arabia PLEs. Actually, if we're talking about events, there may be Raws and SmackDowns connected to those. But three PLEs in Saudi Arabia next year was, I think, maybe the most meaningful new bit of news coming out of the call for WWE, at least.
Yes. And after all, we have made the further inroads when it comes to the breakdown of the Saudi Arabia shows long, long ago when they were just simply large scale international events. We are no longer afraid of saying Saudi Arabia. And in this instance, on this call, the first time we've had WWE/TKO put a definitive figure of value on the Saudi Arabia shows at $55 million, which I would have to imagine they're not just uplifting the Royal Rumble and going there for the set fee when they could simply host its regular events at that price and hold Royal Rumble to a large gate over here. I would think we will find out if there is a meaningful increase for a larger event like the Royal Rumble next January.
Yeah, I feel like with financial numbers, they're a little bit more willing to be transparent. Like they were willing to say, "Hey, from NBCU for that last quarter of Raw that we're extending, it's going to be $25 million." They're a little bit more willing to say, "Yeah, it's $110 million that we're getting every year from the Saudi government for our two events." They're being a little bit more clear, whereas I feel like maybe in the WWE era, they were holding on to that clarity.
So we also had. The last time we spoke, Brandon, you had just reported on some of the inner discussion among TKO staff members and what programs are changing under the new ownership, this in relation to access to company stock at a discounted amount, the WWE Superstar program that we were learning about, as well as raises in the company. And this apparently was raised at a forthcoming or a more recent town hall meeting. Is there anything you can share as it relates to your reporting and how this might have been a talking point inside TKO headquarters?
So I reported a couple weeks ago, morale has been down among a lot of W corporate employees because, as you mentioned, the benefits have been cut. The W Superstar program, this incentive program where they could get cash or other rewards for doing a great job, peer-to-peer recognition, as well as you mentioned, the discount, 15% discount on the stock in the WWE era that they were able to take right out of their paycheck and put into buying stock at a discount. As well as access to live events, but also the pay, the compensation that after a positive review in another era, a couple of years ago before the merger, they would often get pay raises. Now they're only getting pay raises that are even with the cost of living increase from year to year. So a question on the next town hall, there was a remote town hall with Mark Shapiro where he took questions. A question about that report was asked, and Mark Shapiro defended that the company's pay is on par or better than industry standards. From what I gather, he did not address benefits. From what I gather, he positioned the report as coming from someone who has it out for WWE. So I did follow up with WWE if they could give me any more information, supporting any data, supporting whether pay is really on par with with industry standards. They didn't respond. I understand he also said something along the lines of, you know, he worked for a company at one time where everybody was getting pay of $250,000 a year or more, wouldn't even get a cost of living increase. I guess the implication is you should be happy with that cost of living increase, because he's worked in places where, you know, if you were over a certain salary, you wouldn't even get that. Although, according to employees that I've spoken to, the concern is more from people who are making less than $250,000 a year.
That would be a pretty safe assumption there. More so interesting just that it was in fact brought up to Mark Shapiro. And I mean, through your reporting, this was not a case of one person that was vocalizing issues.
And I heard from more people who I did not even speak to before writing the article, after I published the article.
Yeah. So this was like multiples that Brandon had spoken to. And I can give you a pretty solid assertion that Brandon does not have it out for TKO.
And I would add that, you know, the people I've spoken to that have told me about their concerns and the morale that they say has been, you know, on the decline because of this, I don't feel like these people are, I am fully aware that the people who are most irritated about this are going to be the people who talk to me. That being said, I don't feel like the sentiment of the people who I've spoken to are bitter, or, you know, or that they just want to whine and complain. But I feel like the things that have been told to me have been pretty balanced. You know, I have people telling me that they appreciate the company, but they just want to be rewarded commensurate with the success of the company and the financial success of the company. You have WWE making all these announcements about, you know, how great their deals are. And you've got TKO spending $2 billion over the next 3 to 4 years on stock buybacks. You've got the dividend just being announced. $75 million per quarter. Every quarter, they're going to pay investors $75 million, but also cutting back on the compensation that they would before the merger. It would be totally normal for them to give people who had excellent performance reviews, to give those people raises. That's not happening, in addition to the benefits, some of the benefits being cut.
Before we dive into the big TKO boxing discussion, which will take up the lion's share of the show, let's just rewind to some of the recent big events from WWE and AEW, go through some stats and figures. While we were gone, WWE returning to Toronto at the Rogers Center to present Elimination Chamber, which they did note, setting a new Canadian record for any pro wrestling event in the country's history. The WrestleTix number was 37,538 for the show at the Rogers Center. And following that, we had this past weekend AEW Revolution taking place at the Crypto.com Arena in Los Angeles, California.
Your favorite arena.
The former Staples Center, yes, under new ownership or new naming rights. 11,322, which is a very significant number for AEW in this day and age. This would be their best attendance since Wembley last August. And domestically, you're probably having to go back to Forbidden Door last year for a show that was at this level. And did you have any takeaways about the run-up in attendance? We should note this is tickets distributed, so this would have comps mixed in with that particular number. But regardless, like
I would generally knock off about 10% for comps, but yeah.
And even if we're going with like 10K or so for the show, that's well above what AEW is generating, and that goes for pay-per-views as well.
Yeah, I would say that this is, I mean, look at Full Gear. Full Gear did over 10,000. Wrestle Dream did not. That was in Tacoma. Grand Slam. This is not based on a ticket map, but this is based on whatever WrestleTix based it on. 11,000 for Grand Slam in Brisbane, and 11,425 for Revolution. These pay-per-views have been holding up pretty well, as opposed to we can show here for people watching video. Meanwhile, the week-to-week TV attendance has continued to fall. We're now averaging what, just under 3,000 for both Dynamite and Collision. These peak events, I mean, clearly get people out of the house or get people traveling a further distance and are more willing to go to these big events. I think you guys described it as, you know, they're sort of like the takeover events, these sort of what, you know, harder core fans see as must-see events. I guess one thought I had coming out of this is that, you know, they should just continue to run these in major markets. I mean, look at LA as the second biggest market in the country. To continue to put these in bigger markets where it's easy to travel to, there's a huge population around it, and that would probably continue to support the attendance on these events being pretty high.
Does this give you, do you have any sense of, you know, looking at numbers, they did have a Dynamite figure last Wednesday that was certainly on the lower end of Dynamite's in its history. But we are now several months into streaming on Max. Are you looking at Max as having a significant impact either way at this point when it comes to the idea that there has been a benefit for AEW that you can discern from the data you've been analyzing?
You know what I need is, if anybody's got it, the data for, is it the Lakers and Mavericks TV ratings on TNT and True TV. So simulcast on TNT, True TV, and Max. So I understand WBD PR announced that it did something like 2.5 million viewers, I believe. So if we could get the TNT number and the True TV number and subtract that from 2.5, now that's rounded to the nearest 100,000. But maybe we would get an idea of what the percentage is, some sort of ballpark percentage. You know, I'm skeptical that the Max stream is adding a huge percentage of audience at this point for whether it's NBA or AEW. I would be pretty comfortable guessing that it's under 10%. I would maybe put the over under at like 5% or something like that. I think it's very important for the future, and you want to be on streaming, certainly. I mean, consider that it's not like we're getting announcements that, and you know, the PR team celebrating what a success this is. It's on Max. Despite the changing in the tier of Max, it's all still going to be on the same tier for everybody. AEW, that is. But I don't think this is making a huge difference. The attendances, are people getting the impression that the attendances for AEW are improving from week to week? Because I still see under 3,000 in Sacramento, under 3,000 for Collision in Oakland. Is that a talking point in the ether?
I don't have a season's pass in the ether anymore. I've kind of disengaged, but it would feel as though kind of their AEW is, I wouldn't say like they've made drastic improvements, but it seems like the bottoming out period, they have at least come out of it, and you are seeing minor increases in several markets, because there were some where we were hovering at 2,000 or below, and we're seeing a slight adjustment above that period, but I wouldn't say they're by any means their attendance is any cause for celebration.
Yeah, I just want to look real quick. What are the most recent numbers we have? 2,800. I'm just going to round 2,800 for Sacramento. That was Dynamite. 2,900 for Oakland Collision. 3,000, just over 3,000 for Oceanside, California Dynamite. Just under 3,000. 2,900 for Phoenix, 2,800 for Cedar Park, Texas, 2,900 for Rosenberg, Texas, 2,700 for College Park, Georgia, 2,300 for Huntsville, Alabama, 2,000, you could round it to 3,000 even for Jacksonville. Now we're into January. It's been consistent, but these, you know, it's almost all these numbers are just under 3,000. We got one that's just over 3,000.
And they have been running a lot more conservative buildings, with the asterisk being tonight they are at the Save Mart Center in Fresno, California, which is an 18,000-seater. Obviously, it's not going to be configured for that amount, but they have about 2,100 tickets.
That is before. Just over 3,000 last count, yeah.
Oh, okay. That's at 3 now. So, I mean, again, it's a fine number by typical AEW standards, but that is a very big venue that they're running for tonight's Dynamite, and then they have Vegas coming this week. So
yeah,
and then
everything looking out into the future is under 2,000, except for Boston, which is back to back.
Let's talk a bit about Netflix, because we had an important week of data coming out, because last Monday was the Raw following Elimination Chamber and the big John Cena turn. Would he even show up at the show? The answer was no, but did people show up? And the streak was broken, Brandon. This was the first Monday that Netflix posted a larger viewership for Raw than the preceding week. They had 3,100,000 views, hours viewed.
Over seven days worldwide.
So an increase over past weeks. This would be equaling their mark set for February 3rd, which was the Monday following the Royal Rumble.
Yes. I think the heel turn, though Cena himself did not appear. I think what we've often seen in the history of Raw before Netflix is when there's a pay-per-view and there's a big angle coming out of a pay-per-view. SummerSlam was often that. Of course, WrestleMania is often that. But when you have a big angle coming out of a pay-per-view, we've seen Raw benefit greatly, and it appears to have done so here too.
Next, on the Netflix docket, the next 3 weeks of SmackDown and Raw are all going to be from European markets, meaning we're going to get afternoon editions of the shows for those back here in North America, beginning on Friday with a show in Spain, I think they are in on Friday. The next month. And all of John Cena's listed dates for before WrestleMania are these international editions of Raw. So he is not advertised for any domestic shows before WrestleMania, which is kind of interesting as well. But we will see what impact John Cena has. And also, if the time zone change of airing in the afternoon and in prime time in some of these European markets, if that's going to have any discernible effect on some of the live viewing for these shows.
House shows of the year.
That's right. Yeah, our first house shows of the year coming in March, which definitely has to be a record for WWE's history of how late in the year they have kicked off their house show campaign.
Right. Except for NXT house shows, of course, if you want to count those, in those small house shows in Florida. But yes, Barcelona is SmackDown. Dortmund, Germany is the first house show of the year on March 15th, this coming Saturday. Hanover, Germany. Brussels, Belgium will be the home of Raw. And then Bologna? Bologna? It's not Bologna, right?
Bologna.
Okay. Yeah, Italy.
Yeah.
Exciting.
Boy, are we going to hear from some international listeners potentially if we screwed up any of that.
I said Brisbane earlier, okay?
Brisbane is fine, is it not?
Yes. I'm saying I said it correct.
Okay. I'm with you on that one. So there you have it. Brandon, how much have you been able, I know you have, you have an equation you have been able to build out of trying to estimate U.S. viewership for Raw without getting into the weeds of the numbers. Would you state that there is a where would you label this? Lucas Shaw of Bloomberg has called WWE's move to Netflix a moderate success.
I would say that's agreeable. For people watching in video, you can see the pink number, the pink line here. And that's lower than what I'm estimating the viewership was this week. So there has been 1 week, I guess, where I can say I'm pretty confident that the viewership was higher than the prior year of the same week. It seems to have been a moderate success. It looks like in some weeks this viewership has been considerably lower than it was in the prior year. We could only guess about why that would be. And we could guess that it's the older audience that's more used to watching Raw for years, decades on the USA Network or whatever. Maybe not having access to Netflix, not being willing to sign up for it. But there's a value in having all of your content around the world in one place, with the exception of SmackDown in the United States. But there are some weeks where it appears to be doing better than, well, I should say 2 weeks other than the debut and the episode after the debut. This would be the third week where I feel like it probably did better. Maybe the fourth week, that third episode of Raw on SmackDown. So it's been okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's a interesting part of this European run is that for SmackDown, given that all the international markets where it airs on Netflix, those in the US are going to be getting SmackDown last. Because it's going to be airing in all these other international markets in the afternoon that the
fire up your VPN,
the USA Network version is going to be, several hours behind, the discourse. So I imagine fans will be totally understandable of this and, everything will work itself out.
Yeah. I will say, part of the math here is questioning whether we should take Video Amp's number, which Video Amp traditionally tends to be 10% higher than Nielsen, or whether we should take the Nielsen number, which would be 10% lower than Video Amp. It does look like the Video Amp data for the debut matched really well with the internal first party data for Netflix. So you could look at the Video Amp data and say, oh, we are doing better, as opposed to what it might be if Nielsen was measuring this, which of course they are not.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Well, we are now going to shift focus, so everyone get ready, because last week we got the official announcement of TKO Boxing, which we, until there is an official name, we're just going to refer to as a Turkio Boxing.
What's up, guys? We have just done a deal to start a new boxing league with Turkey, who absolutely loves the sport of boxing.
I am very happy today. I give the flag of boxing to the best man who can handle it. He have a tough job now, but I am sure he will be delivering to the people and the fans the magnificent league and get boxing great again.
The model is proven to deliver the fights that the fans want to see. The best will fight the best, and the fighters will continue to move up the rankings and become world champions. We will continue to make announcements on where you can watch and all the rest of the details on the business as we get closer to the launch. I'll see you soon.
Who was that speaking?
That was one Dana White you may be familiar with. And the man that we want to hear from joining us now, part of the Hey Not the Face Substack, which is a must read and a must listen if you're trying to navigate the political minefield that is TKO. John Nash is joining us here on Pollock and Thurston. John, thank you so much for taking some time to chat with us.
Thanks for having me on, gentlemen. Not much is going on, so I don't know what we're going to talk about.
No, it's pretty quiet. We've just got Dana White and Turki Alashik trying to turn the boxing world on its head. And with about a week, you know, it really goes back much further than that about the building blocks of this TKO boxing promotion being put in place. But we got with the official announcement last week, every boxing promoter under the sun is reacting to this. The boxing industry has many, many questions. What are some of the big questions you have looming when it comes to the execution of this and navigating a world that's much different than the MMA industry that Dana and company cultivated?
Well, really, we have nothing but questions still, because if you listen to the PR press release they did and the news cycle they did, all the appearances that Turki and Dana White did, they really didn't say much. They made big bombastic comments, and they did suggest in some ways. Hold on one second. I forgot to mute my phone here. Unprofessional.
It might be muted.
Why is it ringing when I already had it on?
You're a busy man, John. We understand.
But I don't know how the technology works when I have it on Do Not Disturb like a professional, and yet it still rings. But anyways, the point I was getting at is that they said all this stuff, and you can read between the lines that they have big plans with Turki. Said we're gonna crush the promoters, lock them in Alcatraz. That tells us one story. But then Dana White was on being interviewed by Dan Raphael in an excellent interview. The best one that came out last week, because he's the only one that asked real questions. And that they downscaled what their plans are on that show, what Dana White was saying. And so the two extremes are, one is, are they really going to be this big threat, which they easily could if you look at the players involved, to the current landscape of boxing? Or is it really a much more a smaller plan for this league? I put in air quotes because even as Dana White said, it's not a league, it's promotion. We just call them a league for whatever reason. Is it a much smaller operation, much less of a risk for everybody else? Because what Dana described was not threatening. Also, I think there's a strong possibility, though, that Dana is underplaying their plans, because why give it away what you're going to do? And Turkey, for some reason, cannot stop sharing what all the ideas that they have. So I think that's a – but there, it's a, in other words, a broad spectrum of possibilities here.
Can you guys explain to me, like, what the Ali Act exactly is, and if that's going to make having a big boxing promotion in the United States more difficult?
Well, if the plan is to monopolize the sport, which a lot of people assume it is, then the Ali Act is a big deal, because the one of the purposes of the Ali Act is to prevent monopolization in boxing. That's been a long-term problem. And this is kind of a fascinating thing in why MMA can be monopolized, because of the connection between pro wrestling. Mm-hmm. People, I'm sure most fans are listening to this are familiar with pro wrestling, but might not know the whole history. Pro wrestling, back in the 20s, boxing, the National Boxing Association – put out the first sanctioning organizations because they were tired of champs ducking each other. The titles were just these ceremonial things. So the state commissions, the New York State Athletic Commission, the National Boxing Association, they put out, they started sanctioning fights to kind of compel the top guys to fight. It would be, it's basically false advertising to claim you're a champ and not. So they introduced that. Soon after that, they did that in pro wrestling with the National Wrestling Association. Now, at the time, pro wrestling was sold as a real sport, but the little known, as a promoter, you have a problem is you are not conducting actual legitimate competition. So you don't want an outside body coming in and telling who has to wrestle who, because in an era when shooters did exist, you could lose your title to someone that could actually wrestle. And so Paul Bowser was a genius at the time, and he introduced with his AWA, not the later Vern Gagne, but the original AWA title, a fake sanctioning organization. NWA followed later. It was no longer the National Wrestling Association. It became the National Wrestling Alliance, but the same concept. We are going to sanction our own titles, our own matches, and take control of it. Well, fast forward to the 1950s, and there's a boxing organization called the International Boxing Club of New York, which monopolized boxing at the time, and the United States government sued them. Others asked the FTC and the government to look into wrestling. They were gonna, but then they decided we better not, because they were told behind the scenes, it's not real. So what's the point of looking into it? We don't want to interfere in what's basically entertainment. And so they left it alone. So fast forward again, MMA shows up. When they're looking for a model to imitate, they can go back to pro wrestling, who was never faced the monopoly antitrust charges that boxing had, and the scrutiny, because it was a theatrical performance at that time. And now MMA was allowed to follow this path. So that's how we got the monopolization of MMA, and why it's different than boxing, and why pro wrestling as well. So in 2000, the Muhammad Ali Boxing Reform Act was passed. And what that is an amendment to the Professional Boxing Safety Act. And it's looking at protecting boxers' financial interest, not just their health interest. And it passed it had all these provisions in it that were supposed to protect boxers. Now, the main ones that apply today is it put a firewall between being a promoter and a manager. You can't be that. Another one is that it required disclosure from the promoter to the boxer of what they're making on their matches. It also said you can't do what's called coercive contracts. You can't demand a boxer if another promoter or their boxer wants to fight someone that you have under contract, you cannot demand that they sign a long-term contract with you, one over a year in length. And if they're mandatory to a sanctioning organization, you can't demand any future rights to them, which is in MMA, you can see the difference is, like, if you want to fight for the PFL or Bellator or UFC or one belt, we will only let you fight for the championship if you sign a contract with us that's long-term exclusive. That's forbidden in boxing.
So you can't like amass a roster of boxers who are with you long term.
Yeah, yeah. You have no, because you don't control the titles, because the titles are separate with sanctioning organizations. You cannot demand that they fight. They sign with you exclusively to get a chance at that belt. So they can always hover outside and wait till they get declared a mandatory to get a chance to fight for the title. And it prevents concentration, prevents people from monopolizing the sport. Now, the problem with the Ali Act is it's never enforced. It's supposed to be enforced by the Attorney General. They have never, the government has never brought a case forward. Who does enforce it occasionally, and a lot of it is not being enforced at all, but occasionally is the right of private action by the boxers. They're allowed to take it to court and point to it and say, this is a violation of the Ali Act. I'm going to sue my promoter, my manager, whatever, for violating it. Much of it has been watered down. Much of it, they found workarounds. But you talk to people in the industry, and there is a couple provisions that have made a big impact. The compensation disclosure, again, the promoters get around it, but managers know more about the finances now than they did what their boxers are making because of that. And the big one is the ban on coercive contracts. That is almost not even practiced in the United States amongst top boxers because they have the finances to go to court. But that's the key to controlling the sport is getting the top boxers. So they basically, because of the Ali Act, coercive contracts have stopped, which is a big benefit to boxers. But the rest of the intent of the Ali Act was to fix the rankings by the sanctioning organizations, things like that. It kind of failed to do that because there was no teeth to enforce that on the sanctioning organizations. But the coercive contract provision did upheld, and that has greatly prevented anybody from dominating, you know, a portion of boxing like they used to, like Mike Jacobs did, like the International Boxing Club of New York, like Don King, like Bob Arum in the 80s with middleweights. Those guys used to run divisions and keep a lot more of the revenue than they do now.
So do you think the thought process is here? I mean, given this is a deal with the Saudi government, maybe just run all these fights in Saudi Arabia and there's no Ali Act.
Yeah, that's a possibility. I mean, the one thing is United States has traditionally been by far the biggest market in boxing, by far. And if you want to, you know, if you want to make money in boxing, you'd want to run events in the United States and rekindle the boxing market in the U.S. As Stephen Espinosa said recently, when you lose HBO, Showtime, now ESPN, and then there's Fox as well, you're losing about $300 million a year in license fees. That's a huge chunk of the economy. On top of that, those platforms are what build up pay-per-views that generate even hundreds of millions of more. So you're talking a gigantic – U.S. has traditionally been about 70% of the boxing market. It's only in the last 2 years that that has disappeared, that it's no longer the dominant player for multiple reasons. So you'd want to do events in the United States. But, yes, the key is with the Ali Act is it might prevent you – from completely monopolizing in the United States, but you could get around it. I mean, Dana White's talking about prospects. Well, another thing, the Ali Act only really impacts fighters that fight 10 or 12 round fights, the championship level fights or top contenders. If he does 8 round matches, okay, the Ali Act doesn't really apply. If you build up to a title, then maybe you do it outside the United States. The thing is, the other key would be that the Saudis would be signing the contracts with Saudi venues as the court of law jurisdiction. Because if you signed contracts in the United States to an American promoter, even if you did it overseas, the Ali Act would apply because you could come back and argue the contract, you know, venues here. But again, yeah, you have Saudis. You could set up, establish your base of operations in Riyadh. The court of venue there is Riyadh. Fight overseas. It's going to be very hard to enforce the Ali Act, because the Ali Act covers all 50 states, District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands. That's the territory it covers, and that's it.
And it does sound like they're keeping that in mind, and that Mark Shapiro has said that they're going to be the promoter and producer for this. It sounds like it's going to be a Saudi company. They're just going to give their services to this company.
They're going to be managing the Saudis company. So this is somewhat similar. It might not 100% work, depending on, you know, how you challenge it, because – in the current Johnson v. Zuffa antitrust case, Endeavor was declared a defendant in the case, and they argued we should not be a defendant because we no longer own the UFC. It's part of TKO. Well, the plaintiffs argued no, they still should, because their executives make up the executives of TKO. They get managerial fees for running TKO. They are the ones that negotiate all the TKO sales and deals. They're the ones that, you know, they have hands on. They're the majority owners of TKO. And the judge looked at it and said, yeah, you know, technically it's a different company, but you really are the company running it. And so you have to hand over disclosure to us in this case, because you're really running TKO. Possibly if people look at the TKO company as the nexus for the Saudis, possibly, I think it'd be hard, but possibly you could take them to court and argue, we really want to sue TKO because in truth, they are the promoter. They're the one running the show.
And it would seem when you look at these various elements at play, you cite the amount of potential television rights that are up for grabs in the U.S. We know Top Rank is out at ESPN. So many of these promoters have hitched their wagon to Saudi Arabia that it really feels as though this, you know, to draw a wrestling comparison of Vince McMahon's national expansion, and we're watching your Vern Gagne's and Bill Watts as these other boxing promoters. Like, when you have TKO, that is the muscle, and there's no, like, cost is not an issue here. Making a profit in year one, like, none of this is the same restrictions that these other boxing promoters have to ultimately make money that TKO is not going to be handicapped by.
Yeah, I'm glad you named the two wrestling promotions I liked as a kid. And then why I stopped watching wrestling when they got wiped off the map, because it's like the product is not the same. I'm not interested in WWF at the time's cartoon stuff compared to I want to see Nick Bockwinkel, God damn it. Anyways, that forget that, you know, me going down memory lane there. The thing is it is somewhat similar. I mean, again, you have this regulation that's supposed to prevent monopolization, but there's loopholes in it. And one of the loopholes, again, is if the U.S. market's no longer the big market, you know, taking outside the U.S. gives you the power to sign everything over there. You no longer are you concerned. The other thing, you know, the promoters have made it easy. They've been kind of Pied Piper into signing with DAZN. No one watches DAZN in America. American boxing, Eddie Hearn's on talking about how hot boxing is. No, it isn't. Boxing is in a terrible state right now, and partly it's terrible is because of the money offered by DAZN, they've migrated majority of American boxing onto a platform Americans don't watch. So the American audience is suddenly shrunk because they're not having easy access to boxing, the boxing that they're used to build up stars. Top Rank, I thought, did a terrible job with ESPN. Possibility that there's maybe some attempt to interfere with that deal. I mean, there is some questions about the lawsuit that Billy Keane filed against Top Rank. You know, it is kind of convenient. It came out now during when they were trying to renegotiate a deal with them, with ESPN. But the American market has been, the slate has been wiped clean. You have this entity TKO that has basically two monopolist powers that make it up. The UFC is a monopoly in MMA. WWF is close to, you know, maybe not quite as monopolistic as UFC, but in the past they were more so. That dominate their industries. They have monopoly rents. They have staff that knows how to run live events. And then on top of that, you add in the Saudis have an ungodly amount of money who multiples what would Dell and Reed have, the people that tried to help PBC kind of take over the business. And they seem to have no interest in a return on their investment, which is great if you're going to spend money. So you put that together, and then you combine it with the influence and connections that Endeavor have. That's a component I think people kind of miss is, yes, they have tons of money. Yes, they have these two organizations that know how to do this and have the staff and who can sell it to, you know, broadcasters and sponsorship. But you have a connection to Endeavor. They have connections, you know, tentacles throughout the entertainment industry to you know, podcasts and shows and stuff. I mean, look at the way they rolled this out. Nothing but friendly faces the whole time on these big shows on ESPN, who Stephen A. Smith used to be represented by them. And they have deals with ESPN. So they're nothing but good news coming out of them. McCaffrey, who works with the WWE, one of their branches of TKO. He's not going to say anything bad about him.
Pat McAfee? On the line.
What's that?
Pat McAfee.
Oh, Pat McAfee, whatever his name is. A kid punter. He's a goddamn punter. You think I care?
He's very popular here in Canada.
Is he popular in Canada? Yeah, no, he isn't, I'm sure. No, yeah, no, yeah. That's another tangent. Americans are, I cannot believe how clueless we are about what we're doing to Canada in America, The majority of Americans. But let's not go down that path. I will rant forever on that. And then on debt, but they also have, you know, they have political influence with the Trump administration and not just Dana White, but Ari Emanuel has influence there. And the other thing people miss too is their connections in the other parts of the entertainment industry. If you're a network and you want to negotiate, let's say a boxing entity to come on, well, do you want to do that when you're negotiating, you know, that you also want UFC, WWE, and the multiple other shows that Endeavor puts together in packages? Do you want, like, do I want to sign these guys, or do I want and not have or not have a headache with Ari Emanuel, who has control over 20 of my top programming? That's an immense amount of fluid. That is power.
And Nick Khan, who has just like his DNA runs through ESPN, and I think he's a huge component to this.
Oh yeah,
whole
Nick.
Equation.
I mean, they brag about Dana White as their boxing guy, but the two boxing guys I think they bring to this are Nick Khan, who's heavily, very much into boxing with Top Rank, and Lawrence Epstein. He used to be the attorney for Top Rank. Those guys really know boxing. They know the contracts, the way it's organized, the way it's negotiated. I think that's their key. That's the key staff they have right now.
So ESPN is currently in its exclusive negotiating window with the UFC. I think most people expect that this window will expire April the 15th, but you have to imagine that this is only sweetening the pot for these negotiations that TKO is out front of, and now here is another aspect to their portfolio when they are speaking with the Netflixes of the world and ESPNs, and this just being like you're buying into this TKO package that comes with all these entities underneath it, and the boxing being a key component, I think, that is going to work itself into this whole negotiating process.
I mean, the other thing I think, too, is these components they have, they're putting together. The boxing, they don't even have a boxing product yet, and yet they probably, because of their influence, their history, and what they're promising, can probably get a deal out of it. But also, they are the only things that are replacements for each other. I mean, the audiences are not massively interchangeable, right? WWE office audiences, I think it's like 10%, 20% watch UFC, same percentage watch boxing, and you can go around that there's a slight overlap, but not a massive amount. But they fill the void that programming want. This is a type of content that'll draw a live audience. It's the type of content we can slot into various times. You know, it's a standalone sport that you can put on a night that so you don't have to compete for NBA, NFL, Major League Baseball content. So they fill the same need, different audiences. But so if you're a network looking for one, only one place can you go and ask and shop for any of them. You can't put them against each other in competition to lower the price. The people that are setting the price is TKO now that have control over all three.
I want to just take a slight pivot here because you did tweet about it over the weekend, and that was at UFC 313, and this was like a fairly big story outside of the MMA bubble, and that was the maybe surprising or not so surprising appearance of the Tate brothers, Andrew Tate and Tristan Tate, and Dana White kind of like arm in arm with these two. And like Dana White has had this Teflon quality going back to the New Year's Eve incident with his wife, that it just seems this guy has gone through things that a lot of other public figures might not be able to withstand. This was an instance where even like people on the extreme right were kind of like just in stunned belief at Dana White being so tied in here. What do you make as sort of the calculus of this for Dana White's own kind of personal brand that he has associated with, you know, figures on the extreme right? But even this, I think, is kind of one where it was just beyond the pale for even the people that are most charitable towards Dana White and some of his public associations.
Yeah, there's a divide in the right between the conservatives, actual conservatives, no matter how extreme, that believe in kind of conservative values. And the Tates obviously spit in the face of those conservative values. They are not, you know, they want traditional values. They don't want people running sex slavery rings, which the Tates, you know, you can say, oh, they have been proven guilty in a court of law. Yes, but in the court of public opinion, it's pretty obvious they're sleazeballs. You know, that I'm not, if you watch Taxi Driver in the audience, if you would have went back in time and watched it, yes, Travis Bickle is not really a hero, but the audience still cheered when he shot Sport because that guy was a scumbucket. Nowadays, I imagine that a lot of people would be like, wow, Sport was a good guy. He wasn't convicted. Why would you shoot him? So I don't know how many people out here have seen Taxi Driver, but yes, it's an all-time classic.
But it does blow my mind, John, that this is this TKO entity. And I know you mentioned the fact that the audiences don't exactly overlap, but it's like on one wing of the company, here is WWE that has done everything in its power to distance itself from Vince McMahon. And here on the other wing of the company is the head of our company, Dana White, openly embracing Andrew Tate. And it's just such a odd dichotomy of kind of the messaging that you get out of TKO, and that ultimately, like, this is sort of in line with what I think the average person off the street associates with the UFC brand, that this maybe would not come as such a stunning association that you would expect to see at a UFC pay-per-view event.
I'm not sure how much thought Dana actually put in this. I'm not sure if he's a big fan of the Tates. The way he talks doesn't sound like he belongs to the same ideological wing. But I think he's bought in the idea that he's a free speech warrior, that he, because he's associated with all these podcasters and they seem to be much more accepting of this and backing Tate and some, a lot of his fighters does, that it would be one thing if Tate showed up to the event. It's another thing that he was seen warmly hugging, shaking him and talking to him. That's the part. And I do think you would think someone in the UFC brand, the PR department would say, this is a terrible move, because it's one thing like, yes, you're you're greeting him and you're just being polite, we could say. But it seems to be Dana White's working on the assumption there's never going to be blowback, that the current administration, that this realignment has taken place and this is the future going forward. I don't know if he's checking the polls. The administration's getting less and less popular. If the Democrats come sweeping back into power, UFC has basically been non-existent to them. They don't care about. Why would you put a target on your back to be viewed not just as the guy often credited as helping Trump win election, but now being seen as buddying up to what most people, and especially liberals and Democrats, find repulsive? I don't know why you'd want to have that target on your back, because it makes it more likely the next administration would assign, you know, if they bring back Alina Khan and a Cantor, that type of antitrust enforcement, stronger NLRB, whatever, you'd think that they would say, you know what, go, I want you to put this name of this company at the top of the list to look into. You know, generally it's unlikely, because the UFC has a lower profile than other companies, but I would think that would shoot them up to the very top of the possible companies to be looked at because of that kind of behavior. So yeah, I get it at all. In other words,
and just to state what the facts are, that the Andrew Tate has been, is his brother too. Andrew Tate at least has been arrested and charged with sex trafficking, with sexual assault. He's not been convicted. And there's been charges in the UK, and he's under investigation as well. Since coming to the United States, he's under investigation in Florida.
Yeah. But both are facing criminal charges for human trafficking.
Yeah. I'm just going to say people say they haven't been convicted, but they are facing charges in Romania. They're now under investigation in the UK and Florida. Yes, they haven't been convicted, but they're on tape describing actions that match what they've been charged with. And you can say, well, that's just people talking in video. Yes, but that's, you know, you are what you say you are sometimes. And they're also on video beating people. And you can say, oh, it's consensual. Yes, I don't care how consensual it is when the person on video has been confirmed to be like 15 years old. So you put that together, maybe even if he doesn't get convicted, the guy is scum. And I think it's safe to say that I'm not crossing the line by saying these guys are scum.
I don't think you are crossing any lines, John. Last thing I just wanted to ask about, because there is no one that has covered the UFC antitrust suit better than yourself. Of course, we had the $375 million settlement, and you've been kind of giving us an update on fighters. It has been a struggle for some of these fighters to actually be aware and claim what is rightfully theirs. Where are we at when it comes to fighters that have claimed this amount, and where... Did it surprise you at all as well about probably a lot of fighters out there that have no idea what's going on in regards to direct income that could be coming their way from the settlement?
It was surprising at first. Now the number of people that haven't contacted the attorneys to verify their addresses, names, is down to like 10% of the class members. So we're talking about 110 or so that haven't done it. Some of those, I'm pretty positive, are aware of it and will contact. I am thinking that some of them are going to wait to the last second so that their name doesn't get crossed off, so people know they're collecting it. For whatever reason, a large number of fighters are worried about making the UFC upset, even though the UFC has come out and told people to collect their money. I know people at the UFC, when fighters have asked them, said, go get your check. It doesn't help us at all because we're paying the money no matter what. But it was surprising for a while. But after a while, I realized just a large percentage of fighters just do not pay attention to this stuff. The good news is, again, that they're now starting to pay attention. People are contacting them, and the numbers whittling down. If you are a fighter, if you know one, they have, I think, over the next 50 days, they're going to send a notice of your claim to you. So you want to verify your address, go to the UFC fighter UFCClassAction.com. They have a button. You can fill out your information so they make sure they can contact you. They will send your claim form. And then after that 50 days, by mid-June, you have to send your executed, in other words, signed claim back in. Otherwise, you forfeit your claim and the money gets divided amongst the other fighters.
And what is the rough amount that someone like a Brock Lesnar stands to make out of this? I mean, I don't think he's the number one, but he would be in that top 1%.
Yeah, the number one's Anderson Silva by our calculations, over $10 million. Brock Lesnar made, what did he make? He made two fights during that period, made $11 million. We know that. I mean, that's in the, we know exact amount he made. I think his, yeah, his amount would be about $3.5 million, I think, is his share. Which is a sizable amount for a guy that, you know, that's
might be his retirement fund.
That'd be a retirement for a guy that might not be working much in the future. That's a sizable amount of money. And it's actually be the second highest purse he ever got. The highest was against Mark Hunt at $8 million, but he never got, I don't think, higher or much higher than $3 million besides that. So.
For more with John Nash, I encourage everyone to go over to heynotthefacesubstack.com, where you can check out his writing as well as audio with Steffi Haynes, which if you're interested in the business of combat sports, I highly recommend you check out all of their fine work over on Substack. And we very appreciate this from a Paul Bowser discussion to Andrew Tate, John Nash covering it all with us.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Thanks, John.
That was John Nash, everybody, joining us. And yes, a cool $3.5 million for Brock Lesnar to just check a box and say, yes, here's my direct deposit information. Further reason why he's probably not hanging by his phone waiting for a phone call of where it is to come. So one thing that we did not play earlier, you know, Turkey and Dana White, they did go on the media run last week. And wouldn't you know it, that a former chairman of WWE's name did come up in some of these interviews. Let us hear from Turki Alosheikh and one of his idols.
WWE, great relationship. I want and I insist to say from here hi to my father, Vince McMahon. This is the man who we beginning together, and after that, I continue with my brother, Nick Khan. Great relationship, and now we are thinking in this league of boxing, with sharing the same vision between me and the GOAT, Dana White, we will success to reach very far place, inshallah, to the fans.
His father, Vince McMahon.
So I was going to say, did you refer to Vince McMahon as his father?
Yeah, move aside, Shane. This is Turki McMahon. Maybe this was going to be the payoff to that storyline all those many years ago. But not the first time, as Brandon did bring up that that post on X from not too many months ago.
January 10th.
January 10th. Okay.
This is the day that the SEC settlement came out.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Where everything in the rearview mirror for Vince McMahon after that particular date. Turki Alosheikh is someone that has an extreme affinity for Vince McMahon. And I would state that if you think that Vince McMahon does not have real estate in Turki Alosheikh's mind, you would be underestimating things. And I think it's very interesting that Turki Alosheikh, unprompted, going out of his way to note Vince McMahon.
Yeah, it's always interesting to see these characters who, I think Pat McAfee is one to an extent, who can say certain things that are taboo for people in WWE to say.
Well, there you have it. That was a great discussion with John Nash about the state of TKO boxing. I mean, what are some of your thoughts, Brandon, just overall? I mean, not like following boxing super intently on a day-to-day basis, but just what this can potentially mean when we're talking about television deals that are going to be coming up, WWE already having a relationship with Netflix that has obviously shown its interest toward boxing, and what even Dana White quietly mentioning at the press conference that he might have to dial back some of his responsibilities with the addition of this boxing promotion, that this is going to be probably the number one focus for a lot of these key players in TKO over the next year plus.
When you think about Nick Khan, is Nick Khan's time and attention going to be taken away to some extent from WWE?
I think inevitably Nick Khan is going to be taken away from certain WWE duties with this taking priority.
I believe his employment contract is good through the end of 2026. So that's almost 2 years from now. It raises questions to mind of who, if Nick Khan were to not be a part of WWE in the future, if he, spends more time in boxing, or if he were to go, take an opportunity somewhere else, like who would be next in line there? And I think that's not Paul Levesque. I think Paul Levesque is the booker and the creative mind and
the Undertaker,
the chief content officer. Now, maybe John Layfield, who would be the business leader of that business side of WWE? And there's no one.
Maybe the other mean Mark.
Maybe Mark Shapiro is enough, and he's certainly the public face of the company at this point.
All right. Well, that's going to bring an end to this show. Brandon, what do you have going on over at WrestleNomics? I mean, not only we went over the TKO revenue, also doing a graph on your estimated revenue projections for AEW over the past year, as well as my new screensaver, the top 10,000 shows of 2024.
Yes, there's a I've done this every year since 2020, I think. Trying to estimate based on data that we have from WrestleTix, based on what we know of their TV deals, etc. Just a revenue estimate. I doubt that they're profitable. AEW, that I believe is beyond the paywall for subscribers only. But your new screensaver for people watching videos right here. We can go through. Actually, do you want to go through the top 10,000 one by one right now?
Outside of whatever followed the Super Bowl last year, here's your top programming: football, 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 college football, 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 NBA.
There's the World Series is there. We have one of the telecasts of the presidential debate is up there. The top UFC telecast is this pay-per-view prelim from last year, April.
This was UFC 300 prelims. Yes.
Pereira versus Hill. Does that sound like a big one?
Yeah. UFC 300 was a very big show for them back in back in April.
And the top telecast all year last year was before WWE was post WrestleMania Raw. So it gives you an idea, and this is free for everybody. It gives you an idea of where UFC and WWE and if you keep scrolling, AEW, where they stack in the vast swath of the top 10,000 telecasts throughout 2024. And there's no streaming caveats to state here in this case.
Yeah, it does give you the argument of a WWE tonnage when you're looking at all of these logos and where WWE and UFC pop up with AEW as well. Yes. I don't think
you've even got the A&E telecasts in here.
That's right. TNA did not crack the top 10,000 for the year, did they?
No, they did not.
No. Well, that's Access TV, unfortunately, not cracking the top 10,000, but maybe it was in the top 20,000 if we get an expanded view. All right. You can check out all of that over at patreon.com/WrestleNomics. On post-wrestling, not only will I be back tonight with Wei Ting after Dynamite, but also up early for members at postwrestlingcafe.com. I chatted with Scott DeMore today for about a half hour. That interview is up for members, and we'll be putting it out for everybody on Thursday, chatting this weekend shows in Windsor, talking about how he navigated a no-compete clause to run his shows last October, a week before TNA was right across the border in Detroit the following week, and using TNA talent. We talked about Tessa Blanchard coming back to TNA and his exit from the company last year.
Discuss tariffs?
The Canadian-U.S. tension and political wrangling did come up as well. Yeah, we even touched upon a new Prime Minister, Mark Carney. We have a Carney for Prime Minister, Brandon.
Yes, I've heard.
Trying to catch up with you guys. All right. That's going to wrap things up. And we will be back, as always, next Wednesday, 1 p.m. Eastern time. Again, a big thank you to John Nash for joining us and all of you as well, as we are back. And we will never take a week off ever again. Goodbye.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.